So now to our guests on the issue of the week. The crisis in Syria and the announcement by Prime Minister Tony Abbott this week that Australia will be taking 12,000 refugees with a priority on women, children and families. The question of persecuted minorities, including religious minorities, got into some difficult sidetracks, and it's perhaps one of the questions we'll explore with our guests. And you can join the discussion a little later, though. I'll give you the nod in about 20 minutes' time. Give us a call on 1300 800 222, 1300 800 222, if you want to join the conversation. Right now, it's a pleasure to welcome Misha Coleman, the Executive Officer of the Australian Church's Refugee Task Force. Misha, good to have you with us.
Good evening, John.
Stuart McMillan, President of the Uniting Church in Australia. Stuart, lovely to have you with us.
Good to be with you, John.
And also Auxiliary Bishop Vincent Long Van Nguyen, Chair of the Australian Catholic Social Justice Council and a former Vietnamese refugee himself. Bishop Vincent, welcome to you.
Oh, good evening, John.
Bishop, let me ask you, you were launching the Catholic Social Justice Council's annual report for those who've come across the seas on Wednesday, right about the time of the announcement. What was the mood in the meeting?
John, the mood in the meeting was one of pleasant surprise. While I was launching the statement, the news came through that the government had decided to lift the intake of Syrian refugees to the additional 12,000 refugees. And we were pleased that the government had responded in this way. And of course, the reason the government responded in this way was because of the outcry, the public outcry regarding the refugee crisis in the Middle East and in Syria in particular.
The voices have been calling long and loudly on this issue. You're somebody who was a refugee yourself. You came to Australia in 1980 from Vietnam. Tell me a little about your own personal journey here.
Yes, John, I was one of those boat people that escaped from Vietnam in the wake of the fall of Saigon. So I arrived in this country, Australia, in 1981, and it was a kind of a full circle for me, as 30-odd years later, I became a bishop and subsequently elected chair of the Australian Catholic Social Justice Council. And in that capacity, I endeavoured to be the voice for asylums and refugees in Australia particularly.
During that period, Australia's attitudes to refugees and asylum seekers changed quite dramatically. In the period at the end of the Vietnam War, from 1975 on to the early 80s, Australia absorbed nearly a quarter of a million people fleeing out of Vietnam and countries nearby. Yet, in the last few years, our attitude has been radically different. How have you felt as you've seen that attitude change over the years?
Yes, well, I remember with pride the way Australia responded to the refugee crisis in Vietnam. And in spite of the fact that the abolition of the White Australia policy had happened just a few years earlier, the litmus test for the reception of Asian refugees who came en masse to Australia was truly tested, and I must say that as a refugee who came to Australia, I felt that I was accepted by the Australian people, and not without the challenges of assimilating to a new country, a new culture. I think refugees, the Vietnamese refugees, have by and large adapted quite successfully to life in Australia. And may I say too that we have made and continue to make a positive contribution to this country. And we can only hope that Australians will see that as an example of refugees being able to make a positive contribution to this country. Mm. And back, yes, to your question about the way public opinion has shifted in terms of the reception of refugees, of especially people who came by boat to Australia. I am saddened to know that the way we as a nation respond to the refugee crisis has shifted in such a way. But I do believe that in the good nature, good decency of ordinary Australians, and given the right political leadership, I believe that the public opinion, the public reception towards refugees can change, as we have seen in this week, John.
Stuart McMillan, let me bring you in. As president of the Uniting Church in Australia, was it a little unfortunate that that religion got dragged in almost at the beginning, when people, some politicians, I think it was initially, said that priority would be given to Christians? It made for an awkward start, particularly given that that religious groups had been among those clamouring most loudly over many years for the welcoming of refugees.
That's true, John. But as you pointed out in your introduction, people came out very quickly to say that our Christian tradition and the gospel story of the Good Samaritan is all about non-discriminatory reaching out to people in their human need, which knows no bounds, and the Apostle Paul said that there was no Jew or Gentile, there was no slave or free, there was no male or female, but we were all one, and that's the true gospel and the heart of the gospel. And so people responded fairly quickly. I think it is true to say, though, John, that the Christian minority have been particularly persecuted, and so there's a basis for some of the reasons that people are concerned for that minority. And certainly in the meeting with the Prime Minister on Friday, the Middle Eastern diaspora churches, their bishops were deeply concerned for Christian minority people who aren't even in the refugee camps, because they can't, for fear of their lives, go to the refugee camps. So
yes, this is one
you
of the
can understand.
Yes, this is one of the points that actually has been made a number of times on programs like this over the last 10 years or so. And in fact, when Mosul fell last year, the enormous difficulties that Mosul, being a Christian city, you know, or a large Christian population in Mosul, were finding that, and it is necessary to point out that minorities do exist, and those minorities do need to be taken care of. But it almost seems as though for a moment or two in that discussion, there was a little bit of sort of almost sort of political correctness seemed to flow over the debate.
I think you're right. But I think we've moved past that, and the meeting on Friday, whilst there was an expressed concern for minority groups that have suffered greatly, there was also a very clear desire to recognise all of those that have faced persecution and horrible atrocities in as a result of the crisis. And the opportunity to be able to rescue 12,000 people from that situation is so much more important than those other religious tensions that may have been there. There certainly was no tension of that kind in the room on Friday.
Misha Coleman, let me ask you. You're somebody who's been working on the coalface and this for a number of years. The Australian Church's Refugee Task Force has been working very, very assiduously on this. Give us some idea of not just the dimension of the problem, but the extent to which this offer by the Australian government is a significant offer in the sorts of asks that you've been making over the years.
Well, I'd have to say it's great that there's a race to the top instead of the race to the bottom that we're used to, John. It's so much better having politicians trying to outperform each other on the compassion meter than, you know, what we're used to, which is trying to outperform each other on the cruelty meter.
We did hear one or two voices from politicians saying they'll take Australian jobs. I think there was a sort of background static there.
Yes, there was, and I guess, you know, that's always to be expected. But, you know, I think their fellow Conservative colleagues really, you know, came back and sorted that out. And really, you know, there's been some fantastic Christian political leadership behind the scenes. And if we look back towards the end of last year, John, Chris Hayes, who's an ALP federal member in Sydney, and Philip Ruddock, the former immigration minister, who was actually whip at the time, they together went on a visit to the Middle East and brought back a report with a number of recommendations which the Church's Task Force supported. And one of those was to really take Syrian Iraqi refugees, and they didn't define a number. And I think that was really indicative of a bipartisan understanding of the dimension of the crisis and the, you know, requirement for us to act. And, you know, there's been a lot of other political and Christian political leadership, you know, behind the scenes for many years. And, you know, people like Russell Broadbent and the new member Craig Laundy have really been working behind the scenes, even though, you know, it is pretty much, you know, political career death to really put your head up and say, you know, what we're doing, you know, is just unsustainable and we need to change the way we're operating here.
What do you think? I mean, the newspapers focus on the dreadful photograph of the young child, but groups such as yours have been working for a decade and longer on these sorts of issues. There's obviously been something building up that enabled this tipping point to have such a powerful effect.
Indeed, and, you know, there's been a lot of commentary even from sort of, you know, the sort of professional communication and PR sorts of people around why this image, you know, sort of worked where others didn't. And certainly, I mean, the vigil the other night was fabulous, but we've had other vigils and other rallies that have, you know, had the same sorts of numbers. And I think with little Aylan Curdy, his face was, you couldn't see his face. And what I think that meant is that a lot of parents just saw a little boy in, you know, nicely dressed clothes and sneakers and could imagine that could be their own child. That was a really, you know, very powerful thing. And I know, you know, many years ago during the Ethiopian crisis. I was talking to a journalist today who was saying that there was a three UK photojournalists who went and did a trip and took lots of photos of horrific images, came back absolutely no public response. They went back a second time, and they very, very deliberately, having done a lot of research, used very Western iconography to frame their shots. And that time when they went back, and that started the whole response and the Geldof response and everything else. So I guess it just shows that you do need to be able to help people identify with the situation. But I was listening tonight to the guy from Human Rights Watch who really retweeted that photo and sort of got it out there on social media, and he was saying exactly what I was feeling when I saw it, because I see this stuff every day, and indeed I've sat in minister's office with much more brutal photos of the scars of rape from Nauru. That was only just a few weeks ago, actually, and so nothing seems to penetrate, and I felt sucker punched when I saw that shot, and that was exactly what he said. He really struggled with the sort of the ethics of getting that photo out there, because generally you don't put out photos of deceased children, but I guess we've seen that. Hopefully he didn't die in vain.
Mm-hmm. You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio through Radio Australia, ABC Around Australia, and via the web to the world. If you want to join the conversation on refugees, religion and Australia's response to the crisis in Syria, give us a call now, 1300 800 222, 1300 800 222. Time to join the conversation. Let's pick up on one or two of the harder issues then. Bishop Vincent, the Australian government's reaction, given that we took in 250,000, that's a quarter of a million, to the Vietnamese crisis in 75, 12,000. Against what we're seeing flood across the borders of Hungary and Austria and into Germany, seems a tiny drop in the ocean.
Yes, John, it does seem an insignificant number in the light of the thousands of refugees flooding into Europe at the moment. Germany has decided to take 800,000 Syrian refugees, and I believe Norway, with a much smaller population, has decided to take something like 60-plus thousand Syrian refugees. Having said that, however, I must applaud the government for increasing the intake of refugees from Syria as a compassionate response to the global crisis. Yes, it's a small number, but it is encouraging, and hopefully it's a beginning of a long term humane, compassionate policy towards refugees. And it's a global phenomenon. It's not just something that only Australia has to deal with. So one should hope that as a global citizen and as a country with a long tradition of welcoming and supporting migrants and refugees, we continue to exercise that global citizenship and that sense of solidarity and compassion, and that should also be extended to people who find themselves in various detention centres, both in Australia and in Nauru and Manus Island.
I want to address that question in a moment, because I think there is an important subtext there that we need to get to. But just sticking on this one for the moment, Stuart McMillan, now, from your perspective, you were sitting in the meeting. What was said about our preparedness to take the 12,000, that is our structural preparedness to take them?
I think, John, all of those that were gathered around the table, and there was a significant number of faith leaders and NGOs, settlement agencies, we're well equipped to be able to resettle those 12,000. The thing that needs to be worked out is the finer detail and the coordination of the goodwill of the Australian public. As you were talking about before with Misha, there's an enormous amount of goodwill. We need to harness and coordinate that in collaboration. So the
Let me interrupt for a moment. Sorry, but goodwill can turn sour very quickly if the processes of integration aren't set up adequately and groups are just seen to be left to basically fend for themselves, and we've seen problems with other minority groups that have just felt themselves abandoned. And younger kids have problems with schooling. And this is a question of, particularly as these people are being regarded as permanent settlers in Australia, these are questions that require a quite sophisticated response.
May I say,
yes,
John,
Misha,
I think you're absolutely right, and the community sector really does need support from the federal government to do this well.
Yep, we're having budget cuts in the community sector.
Well, that's right, and indeed the settlement services, the very agencies that are going to be asked to really take the lion's share of the sort of work to really properly resettle have recently been, had their budgets severely cut. And I think there's a real role for the ethnic entities here in Australia that will, really be the front line. And tonight I was talking to the Assyrian church in Sydney. There's about 20,000 Christian Assyrians in Sydney, and they have one full-time staff person. They already have a client load of about 500. Mm. And really it's because of the enormous distance barriers and so many ways, those sort of entities are going to be absolutely critical to have a successful and long-term program. So they really do need financial support from the federal government
this properly. The government's saying it's going to give $44 million to this. Yet, as I understand it, it's almost double that amount that was cut from the sort of relevant budgets.
Well, the numbers are an interesting part of this equation, because there was a great letter in the Age newspaper actually this morning that was talking about the differential cost between being cruel and being kind. It was talking about the cost to keep somebody on Nauru or Manus Island at the moment. It's $500,000 per person per year, and yet the sort of estimates in terms of the sorts of money that the federal government's talking about at the moment, it's more like $15,000 per person, and they're sort of talking about for 4 years. But of course, if people are unable to work, if people are unable to, be accommodated in decent and reasonably sort of costed housing, it'll make a huge difference to that cost. But I go back to those sort of, the costs are all relative, John. And, I was a bit disappointed, I'm sorry to say, in the ABC when this announcement first came out, was talking about the costs of taking in the 12,000, talking about, $700 million. But what are the costs of the airstrikes? Because don't forget that was the second part of that announcement. And, you can't pull apart those two announcements because they were made hand in glove. And so, the current estimates of what it's costing to run airstrikes and that incursion at the moment in the Middle East is thought to be about $500 million per year. So there's been no estimates or no questions asked, indeed, about what this sort of new left-hand turn by 10 degrees that the Air Marshal's talking about is going to cost us. So I guess there is always money, and it seems for asylum seekers to lock them up in offshore detention, there's a bottomless bucket there.
Well, let's pick up that issue now, because Bishop Vincent's already raised it. The question of the apparent inconsistency. Scott Morrison was very quick out of the blocks to say this will not change our attitude to those coming to Manus Island, or currently at Manus Island and Nauru, be it they be Syrians or whatever else. It, this is not going to change. Those people still will not gain entry into Australia. Stuart McMillan, what was the response of people at the meeting you were at to that sort of statement?
Well, I think the thing that that everyone at the meeting wanted to do was to say, this is a new day. The government has done something that's compassionate and acting in a far more, we hope, bipartisan and humanitarian way, and perhaps it's the beginning of something new. So nobody in that meeting was wanting to take issue at that time with those things that we are still very concerned about.
Do you see it as problematic? Does the Uniting Church see it as problematic?
We certainly have a number of things about the existing policy that we're concerned about and that we'll continue to advocate about. And Nauru, for very obvious reasons, out of the last report, should be closed, and children shouldn't be in detention. And there's other things in the policy that we will continue to advocate about, but we don't want to detract from the fact that this is an important first step. It's a compassionate first step, and we want to recognise that and see if we can't shift the conversation. I recognise what you're saying about what's been said about the people that are in detention, and we need to keep advocating with the government about that. But we also need to acknowledge the shift that's happened in this particular decision.
Bishop Vincent, the Catholic Social Justice Council, what's its view on the statement by Scott Morrison that things in the camps won't change?
Well, we are concerned about the continued rhetoric on the part of the federal government regarding the asylum seekers who are being held in detention centres, both onshore and offshore. There's this demonization of asylum seekers who came here by boat, and the title of these of our social justice statement this year is taken from the national anthem for those who have come across the seas, and of course the next sentence is we've got boundless plains to share, and we want to call on Australians to exercise that sense of solidarity and compassion that typifies our country even from its beginning, and the continuation of the indefinite detention of asylum seekers in Australia and in Nauru and Manus Island is contrary to that spirit and certainly inconsistent with what the government have just done in relation to the Syrian refugees.
Is there not a deep ethical question here which hasn't often been articulated? That is, even if one agrees that you need to find a way of deterring people smuggling, the people who are in those detention camps are, in effect, being held as hostage against people smugglers, including children, because they are not the smugglers. They are guilty of no crime. They are people who have come to Australia by paying a passage to people smugglers. Misha, it seems that we're prepared to hold innocent children to ransom on this issue.
Yeah, it's like there's only one answer. If you want to stop deaths at sea, you have to have, you know, mandatory detention of children in offshore processing centres. And it's hard to imagine that there are not brains and minds around in the government that can offer up alternatives to that. And indeed, if for people who arrive in Malaysia as their sort of first country of asylum, if you like, when they arrive, it takes up to 18 months to 2 years to get their first appointment at UNHCR. And then, obviously, you know, there's no quick process after that. Similarly, I was told the other day that the waiting list to get their first appointment, people's, you know, to get a first shot at telling their story and explaining why, you know, they need protection in Indonesia is more like 3 years. And that's so when there is nothing for years in front of you, people do get on boats because, you know, especially if they've got kids and they're trying to get them to school and that type of thing. But there are a lot of alternatives to mandatory detention in the gulags in Nauru and Manus Island. And processing people early and quickly where they first arrive is one approach. And you can have mobile processing teams and... Of course, you can't just process people. You really need to put some resettlement places on the table. And the suite of alternatives, you know, that was outlined in the expert panel, for example, you know, is well known to people, you know, and governments. But the it's the cruel ones that have been cherry-picked under this current framework. And just going back to your point about the numbers, the sheer numbers, you know, we're taking 12,000. A significant aspect of that is that they are permanent places, and I mean, and that is different from, you know, some of the offers of other countries. But in the last 2 days, Greece has received 12,000 people in 2 days. And I guess the difference is, you know, you can offer people protection and look after them. You don't necessarily have to resettle everyone. And I guess, you know, I really hope that hand in hand with this this offer, you know, Julie Bishop, our foreign minister, is also trying to pressure the Gulf states to take in people, because really, you know, people from Syria and Iraq, obviously, that, you know, that they want to work in countries where not only do they speak the language, but where their qualifications are going to be recognised. A doctor doesn't want to have to retrain, or shouldn't have to, you know, retrain if they can work in a neighbouring country in their own language. And of course, you know,
they're co-religionists.
Yes. Well, yeah, indeed. And so, you know, the Gulf states take in a lot of labour, but it's, you know, generally menial, sort of, you know, household manual labour, and they haven't stepped up in any way, shape or form to take in any of these refugees and asylum seekers, where there are real skills shortages. And just on the skills, I mean, Germany has one of the lowest birth rates in the world at the moment. I think it's even surpassed Japan. So Germany is seeing these sort of asylum seekers and these refugee flows as an economic opportunity, not a burden, as we sort of are talking about it at the moment. And you know, people with very, very, you know, high qualifications and, you know, high levels of education are going to really provide that, you know, that replacement population in a country that's not replacing its own.
Well, let's take some calls on Sunday night, 1300 800 222. Thanks for hanging on. Welcome to Peter in Austinmere. Hello, Peter. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Thanks for waiting.
And I'm all in favour of people being persecuted, being rescued. But are they saying that Christians are being persecuted in the refugee camps where we would be taking the people from, or are we going to take them direct from Syria where they're being persecuted?
Misha, would you have any information on just how we're going to be doing the selecting? Or
well, I think Stuart was at the PM's meeting on Friday, might be able to say something on
that.
But I can tell you, Peter, that there are Christians who are registered with UNHCR but who are not living in camps. And one of the reasons for that is indeed, you know, I just heard a story this afternoon about, you know, a Christian woman who was raped and then then shot in the head. You know, there is persecution in Syria, in camps, you know, all over the Middle East. But in terms of the way people are going to be selected, Stuart, was that discussed?
So, yes, it certainly was, Misha, and you're absolutely right. That's a horrific story, but it's a story that's repeated.
You're suggesting people are afraid to go into the camps because
absolutely.
Absolutely, okay. And the leaders of the Middle Eastern churches that were in that meeting, and the leaders from the Islamic community, all agreed with that is the case. Mm. The thing that Minister Morrison said in that meeting is that they're going to use two legal protocols, if you like, for the 12,000. One is the protocols we have around refugees. The other is the protocol around the special humanitarian program. And I think I'm quoting him correctly when I said that will enable us to reach our hands into those places where people aren't in camps and to rescue them. And so, as I understand it, they're going to use both those programs for the 12,000, not just the refugee program.
Peter in Ostermere, that
makes a lot more sense now. Because I couldn't see that if I'm presuming that we're safe in refugee camps, so therefore, why wouldn't we just be taking them on the face? You know. Mm. Yeah.
Thanks for your call. You're on Sunday Nights. We're talking about refugees, religion, and our Australian response. Don in the Central Coast. Hello, Don. Welcome.
Hello. How are you?
Yeah, good. What would you like to say?
Look, I'd like to just, much as I understand and appreciate the need, the ethic and the morality of trying to save as many of these refugees as we can, I think that the whole Western world should be also seriously and urgently, and church groups, everybody should regard what is happening in Syria and by ISIS as absolute wholesale murder. It will become on the scale of the Japanese murder of the Chinese, which ran into millions. Now, much as you solve or try to solve a small amount of the refugee problem, the refugee problem will continue to grow, will expand, will go on indefinitely unless you try and stop the reasons for the movement. It's no good just trying to take out, for example, one Toyota with a machine gun on its turret by aircraft. The Western world needs to actually put some huge force and make some serious effort to tackle this problem on the ground. That's not popular because nobody likes to face the reality that some aggression has to be dealt with and has to be curbed. Otherwise, you will have the unchristian attitude of rape and pillage and murder in the most horrific way for thousands upon thousands. You are playing with the world is playing with the edges of the problem.
Don, thanks for your observation. And we won't get, we won't get into the military question because you're right. There is a legitimate strategic question there. But you also raise a deeper question. And Bishop Vincent, I'll get you to comment on this first of all. And that is, are we not looking at one aspect of a problem? That is, the world is going through a period in which population movement is becoming much easier, communications is much easier. We can see on our iPhones what's happening on the other side of the world. Everybody can tailor their communications. We are looking at a period where there is going to be much more geographic instability, and that as a country we need, and as a world, we need to prepare ourselves for this. I think Pope Francis has sensed something of this.
Yes, and Pope Francis talks about creating a culture of encounter as opposed to a culture of indifference. And we are more and more conscious of the movements of people around the world, whether through economic migration or the refugee crisis that is unfolding before us today, especially through modern technologies. But that doesn't mean that we stand aside and do nothing when there are people in dire need that appeal to our conscience, to our decency, to our best nature, and we might not be able to solve the refugee problem, as the gentleman earlier pointed out. But when there is a dire need of a fellow human being, and I think you know, the Christian teaching is that we attend to the person in dire need.
Yes, the difficulty is to get us to see who is the other, and the other is us, I guess, Stuart, in this case.
Yeah, look, the other thing that I would go back to is what Bishop Vincent was saying before about Australia being a global citizen. And it seems to me that in policies like the boat turnbacks, we ignore our global citizenship, and we act in a base kind of self-interest way. We ignore the effect on Indonesia, for example, and Misha was just talking about taking 3 years for somebody that finishes up in Indonesia to even get to talk to the UN about their circumstances. We ignore that we're part of a larger region and in a global context. And if we're going to take what we're talking about seriously, what's happening across the globe, we've got to approach this issue in the same way as we would approach some of the economic issues and the other issues that our politicians approach through ASEAN and through those regional global groupings. We can't just act in a kind of self-interest way as an island unto ourselves. It's just not going to. It's not responsible.
We're going to take another call. Don, thanks for your observations. The military strategy is probably a little beyond us, even though we do acknowledge the reality of what you've observed. Kevin in Bunbury. Hello, Kevin. Welcome. What would you like to say? Kevin, we can't hear you. Can you get closer to the phone? No, Kevin, we're going to have to leave you, I'm afraid. A little problem there getting onto your call. Let's go to Andrew in Hobart. Hello, Andrew. Welcome. Andrew, are you there? Oh, well, one more. Alan in Hunter Valley. Alan, how are you?
Hello?
Yes, Alan. Is that you?
This is Andrew, but no.
Andrew. Well, good. We've got Andrew from Hobart. Hey, apologies for that. No, I've probably been off air for so long I've forgotten how to press the buttons.
All right. So my question to the panel is, look, in my opinion, it is understandable that somebody who is a Muslim would lie about their religion and claim that they are Christian, given what Tony Abbott has said about will only take Christians to get into the country and escape danger and to get to safety. Now, how are they going to check? And how are they going to know? And secondly, why on earth are they even discriminating against, you know, Muslims and Christians in the first place when 0.003, I think it is, percent of the Muslim population is extremist? That is a tiny number. I believe that's the case, that are associated with ISIS or ISIL.
Andrew, can I respond by saying I really think that despite all the, you know, the hyperbole,
yep,
there is no intention, as I understand it, and Stuart might be able to add to this from Friday's meeting, there is no intention to prioritise Christians over Muslims. There is an intention to prioritise people in terms of who is in the greatest need. They may be Christians, but I don't think that they're... I think that it's well understood that you know, but by having any sort of a policy or any sort of a lens that prioritised Christians would be in a highly divisive and unhelpful, you know, way to go about it. And I think, I mean, the other thing that, you know, people have been talking about is, you know, whether extremists will be allowed in somehow, you know, under the radar, that type of thing. I mean, the reason there's not Hercules in now trucking people in is that there will be security screening for everybody. People don't have their documents. Everybody needs to have health checks, security screening. But I don't think that should be interpreted as, you know, trying to screen for Muslims or trying to, you know, make sure they're, you know, any sort of faith background. I think the political leadership has really got that sort of well established. And, you know, I think we all saw the images of the Yazidi Christians, you know, trapped in Iraq last year. We must understand that there are Christians who are, you know, in a very, very dire place. But of course, we know that there's a whole bunch of other faiths that are being equally, you know, persecuted.
We're going to have to wind the discussion up. It's gone too quickly. Apologies if you called in on the board and didn't get through, but we've run out of time. But if you wish to follow up with any of the bits and pieces we've discussed tonight, we'll put the contacts for the Social Justice, the Catholic Church's Social Justice Council on our website, and the Australian Church's Refugee Task Force and the Uniting Church contacts as well. So you can do that. And thank you very much to our guests, Auxiliary Bishop Vincent Long Van Nguyen, to Misha Coleman and to Stuart McMillan. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Good to be with you, John.
Thank you, John.